You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. Well, I'm not revisiting a film this week, and this particular film I probably will never revisit on the history of Monster Attack. Folks, I was so torn in wanting to do this movie, and I'll tell you why I was torn, because it's celebrating a 50th anniversary of its release in 1972. But the second part that was tearing at me was that it meant I had to watch the movie again. Yes, folks, this is a bad movie. I'm going to say that right up front. This is a very, very poorly made film. And I want to do this show not like a rag-a-rama, although there may be some funny things that come out of it. I'm purely going to go off the top of my head on this. I've seen this film twice now in the last 3 weeks, and just recently, a couple of nights ago, so that I could do this podcast. It took me a little, you know, it took me about 48 hours to get my wits back about me after seeing this film. It defies description in some places, and I'm not going to rag on the actors, because the actors are pretty good actors. Maybe not based on what they did in this movie, with a couple of exceptions, because there are a couple who sort of stand out above everyone else. But, based on their other careers, and you're going to see and hear about a lot of people that are very popular. Okay, what are we talking about? We're talking about the Doomsday Machine, or also known as Doomsday Machine, or also known as Escape from Planet Earth. It's been released under all those titles. I believe Escape from Planet Earth was the title that was used when it made a few television appearances. But folks, this film was so bad that it made very few television appearances. Now, you've heard us rag on Larry Buchanan's films, where he took some like classic Corman films and he was paid to redo them, to remake them for just strictly for television. Films like Zontar, Thing from Venus, and It's Alive, not to be confused with Larry Cohen's brilliant film, and others like that. This film doesn't even come up to that capacity, folks. It's a science fiction sort of disaster movie, I guess you could think, an apocalyptic film. Looking at the thumbnail of the movie's synopsis, you might think, hey, this would be a pretty good movie, because they had a good idea here. But lack of money and then rushing this into production destroyed any chance this film had of being a good film. I'm not going to tell you not to watch it. I'm going to tell you that this film probably sits in that category where, oh, yeah, Jim talked about this movie, let's go watch it. And then at the end saying, why did he have us watch this movie? So I'm not going to say either way. There are some critics that say, oh, it's just so bad, it's a good movie. It's not one of those. Folks, I don't consider myself an expert on those kind of films, but for most of my life growing up, I loved bad movies that were fun to watch, that were good to watch, and I collected many of them. I'm a huge Ed Wood fan. I had a lot of admiration for Ed Wood, not in his filmmaking style, but in his filmmaking perseverance. The fact that he actually got films made and put on screen, even though they were atrocious in some cases, but they were always fun. And there was rarely a time where an Ed Wood film was boring. But sometimes, you know, he did. Near the end there, he made some boring films, ones that I don't care that much for. But his early stuff, I love watching, and I can watch it over and over again, and it's just so inept. And there's so much heart in his films that you got to love it. But this film fails on all these accounts. So, I mean, I think even this is the kind of movie that makes some of Ed Wood's stuff look good. It might even make Larry Buchanan's stuff look good. That's pretty rough. This film started out being shot in 1967. But I just said that we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of its release. Why am I not doing its 55th anniversary? Because in 1967, they started shooting this movie under the direction of Herbert J. Lederer, and it ran out of money. This is what most of the folks that write about the history of this film think happened, that it ran out of money and it just stopped in production. And for independent films, that can happen quite a bit. I've had a few personal experiences in my own career with films that we got going on and that I was an actor in, and all of a sudden it came to a stop. They ran out of money and never picked it up again. One that I did 5 years ago that I was sort of hoping they would pick back up again. You can always hold up hope. But that's what happened here, apparently, in 1967. They couldn't finish the film. So they had some footage in there, and you're going to notice in Doomsday Machine that there's a lot of stock footage, which you might say, well, that's not so bad. I mean, you know, a lot of the films that you talk about from the 50s and you know, some of the monster movies that came out during that time period used a lot of stock footage. Yes, but most of theirs was good, and they could match it up pretty well. I mean, even Ed Wood tried to match his stock footage up with his. He wasn't always successful at it, but at least there was an attempt. But in this film, there's no attempt at all. And that goes into how I think this film was actually produced before it went out on the screen. So 5 years goes by, and I guess some money comes about, and they're able to finish this movie. And and they hire a guy. Now, Herbert J. Lederer, good director. You know, he was a pretty good director. He directed The Frozen Dead. I think we talked about that a couple of years ago, the last drive-in film that I saw with my dad. So it's a very, very special film. But they ended up, the producers ended up hiring two more directors, Harry Hope and Lee Sholem. Well, actually, Lee Sholem, but actually Harry Hope was one of the producers on the film, and Lee Sholem had a reputation for being a very efficient director, did a lot of television. He never came in over budget, and he was always on time. And that's something that in this situation really was something that the producers needed. So apparently they got just enough movie to reshoot a lot of the film, but there was one problem. The cast that we're going to talk about tonight only participated in the 1967 stuff. So by the time 1972 came around, they weren't available. And there's some pretty good people on this cast, and we're going to get to that in just a second here. But talking about Lee Sholem, he did basically, at last count, if you count all of the television episodes that he directed, as well as a few features, more than 1,300 projects. Pretty good. Now, he only gets credit for 39 if you look up his resume, and that's because for the television series that he was involved with, and he was involved with some pretty good TV series, Death Valley Days, he did several episodes there, Maverick, Miami Undercover, Cheyenne, Bronco TV, Sugarfoot, Colt 45. You get the trend there, all these westerns from the 60s. Men into Space, he did four episodes of that. Grand Jury, Lawman, yeah. So this guy, I mean, he did just nonstop directing through the 50s and the 60s and right up until 1972 for his final project. Have you guessed where I'm going with this? Final project? The Doomsday Machine. He had been retired for about 4 years when Harry Hope got in touch with him and said, Lee, we need you on this project. So here's the challenge that Lee Sholem has. He's got to find a way to shoot around the fact that his cast is no longer available. So they've got to mix the existing footage from 1967 in with the footage they're going to reshoot in 1972. So because of that, it creates all kinds of continuity errors and goofs and gaffes and just the kind of things that would drive you crazy watching a movie. And that is the one thing, like I said, I'm not going to get on the actors because it wasn't their fault. they did everything they could. The problem was the situation. This was probably a project that should have been scrapped and never you know, pulled out of mothballs 5 years later to try to finish it. You've heard Mark and I talk a lot about what the United States, you know, some of the United States production companies did with some of the Japanese monster movies, like Godzilla, where they would take a complete film, or Varin the Unbelievable. They would take a complete film and then put American segments to it and all that. And that's sort of what's happening here. But try to imagine doing that without a cast on the modern stuff. So this is what Lee Sholin was faced with. So I'm not even going to get on Lee, because I've seen some of Lee's work and I've liked his stuff. He was a very competent director. And a lot of the TV shows I grew up watching in the 60s, he had a hand in a lot of them. Because I watched a lot of those Westerns back then, like Cheyenne was one of my favorite Westerns, and others like that. I don't think he ever directed an episode of The Adventures of Superman. I can't remember if he did or not. Might have. He might have. Because a lot of directors back then did. But 1,300 various projects that he worked on, that's including every episode of every TV show he ever directed. And that's the majority of the stuff he's doing. Folks, this looks so amateurish, and it looks just so thrown together. I don't want to misguide you in any way. So I'm going to tell you first, before I get into the cast, we're going to tell you about the storyline. The storyline involves a manned flight to Venus, and the United States is going to send 6 people to Venus and bring them back safely, hopefully. Now, keep in mind, you know, and I'm trying to think back when I was a kid, when we started learning, you know, what the atmosphere of Venus would really be like and all of that. Because, you know, for a long time, we assumed it's the closest planet to us, so it'd be the most logical one to go land on. It's even closer than Mars. But then as we learned that, you know, the atmosphere is basically almost sulfuric acid, and the pressure and the heat being so close to the sun would make it virtually impossible for a manned landing on Venus. The brief pictures that we have seen from that Russian space probe that landed on Venus years ago, don't really even give you the idea. It looks like it's sort of like desert terrain. The thing got, the spacecraft got crushed. Yeah, fortunately, the pictures were beamed back to the Soviet Union before that happened. So, you know, we've pretty much all but given up, you know, any concept of landing a manned craft on Venus. It would just be, I mean, not with the technology we have now. It would be virtually impossible. But back in the 60s, you know, a lot of the films that I was drawn to as a kid were the ones involving Venus missions, because I was so fascinated with them. I mean, yeah, we knew that eventually we were going to go to Mars. And I still hope in my lifetime I'll get to witness a man or a woman or both walking on the surface of Mars. But I have no delusions about the fact that I doubt, you know, we would ever see a man landing on Venus, ever. I would love to see if we could pull off the technology to land a space probe on Venus and just take some pictures. But, you know, even the, you know, like the stuff we're doing on Mars, it's going to be impossible with the pressures and the just the brutal conditions that exist on Venus. And you're so close to the sun, things just burn up. I mean, I forgot what the average surface temperature of Venus is, but it's brutal. It's like being in an oven. So you've got this mission. The astronauts are having their final press conference, and the mission gets sped up. And all of a sudden, now they've got to go. I mean, it's like within a matter of hours, they're going to launch this rocket ship with these 6 guys in it and head to Venus, and nobody knows what's going on. And then to complicate matters even worse, at the last second, within an hour of them boarding the spacecraft and taking off, the big government brass, they show up and they go, okay, three of you guys are not going. And they say, well, thank you for all your trouble and all of that, but you're not going on the mission. And they bring in 3 women who are going instead. So that's the tip-off right there. You know something's up. Of course, they don't know something's up. But, you know, of course, it's obvious what they're doing. This is going to be a contemporary Noah's Ark, and they needed women on there so that wherever they go, they're going to be able to breed and save mankind, because we're at the peak of war. Now, this is 1972. Cold War is still still a huge, huge factor, even this late in the game. I mean, it would not settle down until the mid-80s when the Iron Curtain fell. And both sides started realizing that nobody wins a nuclear war. Nobody. And I think that's what makes, you know, what's happening nowadays a little frightening, because there are some people now that have forgotten that. But we're not going to get into any political here. So the world is, they believe, the government believes the world's coming to an end. So they're going to send up three men and three women. And, of course, the men involved who are going, these veteran astronauts, are going, wait a minute, there's going to be no privacy on this thing. You know, we're all huddled in this small spacecraft. It's got two levels to it, from what I remember. Yeah, I should have known. I wanted to go back and check that, but I couldn't stand it, folks. I'm sorry. And so here they, you know, and they don't really understand the significance of what's going on. But they, so once they get launched into orbit and get ready to get in their insertion orbit to head to Venus, then they sort of figure it out and they go, yeah. And then they witness the Earth getting destroyed, because tensions have been heating up between the Soviet Union and China and the United States. And it appears that it's inevitable. And they never say in the movie who started anything or whatever. It's just like you see this. You see this beach ball blow up, you know, against a dark curtain, and that's, you know, the Earth blowing up. Folks, the special effects in this movie are so bad, that when I was a sophomore in high school, I took my 8mm camera, and I made a 10-minute motion picture called The Invader, and it was about a space alien who invaded the Earth. And he was going to kill as many people as he could as a vanguard towards a bigger invasion from a nameless planet. My special effects, and I'm not bragging on myself because it was a rough little film, but you know the kind of films that the kids make at that age. But it turned out pretty good, you know, for a 10-minute movie. Pretty good. So this one doesn't even look that good. A lot of the special effects are stolen from another film called Gorath. You might be familiar with it, an old sci-fi. So all of the exterior shots that you're going to see in outer space of the spacecraft and space station that's supposed to be up there and all of this, all these gizmos, are basically just ripped off from their entirety from Gorath, and they're bad effects, folks. They're just basically little plastic gizmos on a string. You know, and they actually float around, you know, because the string's moving. I mean, it has to be seen to be believed. But I'm not telling you to go watch the movie. That also set up Lee Sholem for another problem that he was going to have with this movie. And that is that, again, they had not shot any of the special effects for this movie. They had the spaceship. We've seen, you know, we see the exterior of the spaceship and stuff. That's about as far as they got when they ran out of money. And they had done the interiors. And the interiors were clearly sets with plywood fixtures. Even worse than the original Star Trek. I mean, you know, we kid around lovingly, Mark and I do quite a bit, and the rest of us, about, you know, one of the charms of Star Trek, the original series. You know what? Everybody did plywood stuff back then, especially in television. And I thought, you know, as I look back, you know, and I've been watching over the years, you know, they did pretty good for 1966. And this movie was shot the year after this. So, you know, I mean, plywood sets were used a lot in space movies, but there are good plywood sets and there are bad ones. And Star Trek was some of the better stuff. They were very creative, and they made their sets look pretty good. This one did not. It was very clear that they were in a, you know, just a regular room with regular lighting with these plywood consoles and things like that. It was just very, very obvious. And that takes a lot away from the movie, too. So those were shot. But the rest of the stuff they get from Gorath, and the only way I can say it, it doesn't match up. In fact, as you're watching this movie, oh my God, again, folks, I won't recommend it, but as you're watching this movie, because some of you are probably going to have to check this out if you know, hearing what I'm saying about it, to see if it really is as bad as I said. And trust me, folks, it's really bad, as bad as I'm saying. Every time you see an exterior shot in outer space, the craft changes shape, literally. So I guess we could say maybe this has got a horror element to it because you got a shapeshifter as a spaceship. That's the only way I can explain this. Because at times it looks like a space station turned on its side that's being pulled on a string across this star field that's hanging on a wall. The lighting is all wrong. It's clearly not outer space. It's worse than some of the worst Japanese special effects. I mean, you know, their little miniatures look terrific compared to this film. But that one just drove me nuts because it's like I never knew from shot to shot what ship we were going to see. And it was still the Astra. That's the name of the ship, was the Astra. But it would change shape every time you saw it, depending upon what footage they used. Also, they have a situation where they had to jerry-rig some stuff because of the inevitable meteor shower and some problems they had with the spacecraft getting damaged. And during that, there was a cutting tool that one of the crewmen, played by Bobby Van, we're going to get to our cast now in just a second here. And Bobby does a pretty good job on this, actually. I always liked him. He died at a very young age from brain cancer, made the scene on TV quite a bit. He was quite a song and dance guy growing up, won acclaim on Broadway. That's how he was discovered. And then he decided to get into film work and made a couple of big movies, a lot of TV work. And then after he was divorced in 1964, just before this film shot, and if he hadn't been, this probably would have caused his divorce. Actually, the cast speaks very lovingly of this movie. We're going to talk about that in a second, too. But Bobby he gets married to Elaine Joyce, who was another fixture on television. Very funny lady, a comedian, and again, a very good comic actor. And they were seen quite a bit on shows like Tattletales and things like that. And then Bobby Van actually hosted a couple of his own game shows. So he found a way. You know, as things dried up for him, as the feature film stuff dried up, he switched to TV and did a lot of projects and was on TV for quite a while until his death, which came very suddenly. They kept it very quiet about his cancer, and he worked right up until the very end. He was quite a trooper and a fun guy, and he is somewhat of the comic relief in this movie because every one of these space sagas always has one comic relief character. So he's the guy he's sort of the jack of all trades. He's the handyman. He can fix things. He knows all the electronics. But he's the radio man, too. So it's his job to make sure they stay in touch with Earth until it gets destroyed, obviously, and all of that. And he has this cutting tool that he's using to make something that they need, that they're jerry-rigging for the spaceship. And right out of the playbook of Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. And yes, folks, I'm going to go out on a limb and say this film makes that movie look pretty good as well. They use a they use a Mattel toy for the cutting tool. And I will reach out to those of you who are about my age who grew up in this time period. If you remember the Zero M Sonic Blaster, anybody remember that? Do I have any hands up in the air? These Sonic Blaster type toys seemed to be the favorites of low budget science fiction films, because as you know, we've made allusions to Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. The Martians' main weapon was a whammo blaster. It was the thing you would pump up and then it would fire a big shoot a big puff of air out. The Zero M Sonic Blaster was like the rifle version of that. So, nothing but the best for the Doomsday Machine. All right, let's get to our cast. Time we got to our cast. We told you about Bobby Van. They got a very likable character, very, very likable character. And again, sorely missed when he passed away at an early age. And I think with the way the business went, you know, if he had survived into the 80s and in the 90s, I think he would have found some substantial work because the channels opened back up again. And Elaine Joyce stayed working for a long time, long time. Our next most recognizable star in this movie is Ruta Lee. Ruta Lee was a beautiful, beautiful, well, everyone shouldn't say was, because she's still with us. Yeah, Ruta is still with us. She's getting close to her 90th birthday. She's 87 years old right now. And, you know, retired from the business. Although she did show up in a project last year, the TV series That's Entertainment. She was one of their special guests. So she still makes appearances. And but she hasn't done anything substantial since 2017, where she did a lot of television work during that time period, from 06 on into 2017. So she stayed busy for quite a while. Was in a ton of stuff. Witness for the Prosecution was one of her big early films. Funny Face, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. She did marvelous work, and I remember seeing her on TV quite a bit. She made the game show circuit. A lot of the TV and movie stars did that back then when we were growing up, all of the big TV game shows. It was great publicity for them, and it was a great chance for them to promote their films. So they didn't mind going on and doing a game show here and there because it gave them a chance to talk about their film or the TV show coming up or whatever it was they're working on, charitable causes, things of that nature. And Ruta Lee was very involved with charitable events, still is. She's the chairman of the Thalians, which is an organization, a nonprofit organization that deals with the treatment of mental health at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. Now, Debbie Reynolds used to be the president of that before her death, but they both stayed involved with that for decades, and Ruta Lee still is involved with that. A lot of people my age probably remember Ruta Lee for the first time in an early Twilight episode called A Short Drink from a Certain Fountain. If you remember that one, you know, that's where she got our attention, because, again, she was absolutely drop-dead gorgeous. And just had this wonderful personality about her. Was married to Webster Lowe for many, many years, 44 years, right up until his death. So again, she's one that we talked about this last week with some of the longtime Hollywood marriages and how unusual that was. They defied the odds as well by staying married for so long. So she studied acting at Hollywood High School. Always had planned on being an entertainer, and it was good. I mean, she entertained for the Army troops, and she did so much work, and did so well at it that she bought houses all throughout the United States. She and her husband, and so every time she had a project, she could go to one of those houses, and she kiddingly said, "I slept around quite a bit as an actress." She had a self-deprecating sense of humor. She didn't take herself too seriously, but she did some fine work. And if you really want to see some of her best work, check out Witness for Prosecution. That was a great way to get a start. And again, very competent actress. Mayla Powers is our next actress. She plays a Russian cosmonaut in this. She is one of the women that has been picked to go with these guys. I guess, you know, on this Noah's Ark, you know, the three pairs of Adam and Eve's that are going to be on this spacecraft. And, you know, they said, how did you get picked for this? And she happened to be in the United States at the time, and her background and her expertise made her a logical choice by the government to send her to on this mission. So again, there's some people in here that have had, you know, some really, done some really good work. I mean, this is a very competent cast. James Craig, who plays the oldest member of the crew, he's the scientist that's sort of helping head up everything. He's a science officer, I guess you would call him. And of course, Craig did a ton of stuff in films and television throughout the years. And again, he is the elder guy in this, and a very familiar face. And we all grew up watching him. Those people my age, we grew up watching him. All kinds of things. Most of these guys were in Westerns because that was so prevalent on television. And then the guy that I think is maybe the best actor to appear in this film, and that's Grant Williams. I think Grant Williams, you know, over the length of his career, was one of the most underrated actors in the business. I still think the work he did in The Incredible Shrinking Man, maybe some of the finest work in a horror slash sci-fi movie ever. And I would almost challenge anybody on that one, because consider this. He rarely in that movie got to act with anybody, with a human being. He had some scenes before his shrinking scenes. Everything he was reacting to a blank stage where they would superimpose the backgrounds, the blue screen back then. And to do the kind of work he did believably and not over the top, and the understated performance he gave in that film, I still think is absolutely brilliant. I'm telling you this because I feel really sorry for Grant. This was the last film he made. You heard me right. This was the last motion picture that Grant Williams would make. Now, he died about 13 years later. Things sort of dried up for him, and then he died of peritonitis. But he'll always be remembered for his TV work on Hawaiian Eye. Even though The Incredible Shrinking Man, Written on the Wind was another big film that he did. But he'll always be remembered for his role on Hawaiian Eye, very popular character. Extremely popular show. You had Grant Williams and Connie Stevens, and just a terrific cast. The last time he actually appeared on television was on a game show as a contestant. And it was on a 1976 episode of Family Feud that was comprised of other actors from Hawaiian Eye. So, because his health took a real serious turn those final years. And it's a shame. I thought he was just such a brilliant actor. But in this film, I don't know if it's Lee Sholem being in a hurry and not giving him specific direction. I'm not sure what it was. This is the kind of movie if you have any fond memories of Grant Williams as an actor, that made this movie really hard to watch. He's over the top. He's sort of the bad guy among the crew. He has his eyes on one of the women. He nearly rapes one of the women, which causes him and her to get blown out of hatch in the spacecraft. Yeah, you heard me right. There's some really goofy things going on in this film. He was almost like bipolar in the way that he played this part, where he could be very, very low-key, like a typical Grant Williams performance, like we saw in Monolith Monsters and The Incredible Shrinking Man, things like that. Yeah, that really understated performance that he was so brilliant at doing. And then just be manic as hell, just over the top. And just, and anyone who has studied theater or been involved with theater knows that, the 10 layers of emotion, one, you're dead, and then 10 is you're totally manic. And you never jump two or three layers at one time. You've got to take it up in a progression, because that's how people do it naturally. So, I know they were in a hurry. I know they shot this footage, the footage he's in, and the cast. I mean, the 67 footage, they shot 8 days. So there was no room for retakes or anything like that. That also hurt this film a great deal. That's before they went broke. And the other guy I want to mention that was in this movie, well, three I'm going to mention. One is a fellow that a lot of us grew up listening to on the radio. But he's a pretty good actor, and he did some stuff here and there on television. But he was known basically for America's Top 40, Casey Kasem. Yes, we've got this one going out to Little Mary Lou in Iowa City, Iowa. It's a terrible Casey Kasem, but I mean, we all grew up listening to him. We all sort of tried to mimic him over the years. And Casey was a great guy. And unfortunately, the last years of his life where he was suffering from dementia were just brutal. But he was fun to watch. And of course, many of us will always think of Casey Kasem as the voice of on Scooby-Doo, of Shaggy. And, he really, he made a fortune doing that. And, it was just a fan favorite when it came to some of his animated stuff. He did other animated stuff too, but I think the Scooby-Doo stuff is always going to be the stuff he's remembered for. I also want to mention Denny Miller. Denny Miller, who was the only blonde-haired Tarzan ever to do the role. And he caught some criticism for all the Tarzan stuff he did, but he said he loved it. He said, it wasn't quite the roles that he wanted all the time, but he just had a lot of fun doing it. And, and actually with films like this, again, none of the actors in this spoke badly about this film. And I think probably after 67, I wondered if anyone saw it. You know, because as an actor, you just sort of move on. You've done it, and you just move on. You don't worry about it. But there was one guy that really distinguished himself in this movie. I mean, and it's so obvious that I've got to mention, that's Mike Ferrell. Yes, we're talking about Mike Ferrell, who was B.J. Honeycutt in the television series MASH. And he plays a reporter in this, and he's got the one scene where they've all got their big press conference going, and they're asking everybody questions about the mission and why it's going so early, and they can't give him an answer because they don't know. And Mike Ferrell asks two questions, and it's very clear. He's a pretty good actor. He sounds very natural. It's not over the top. It's not, I mean, you've probably seen people in some of these movies, and you'll see it in this movie, an actor trying to be a reporter, trying to act like they are a reporter. It's just brutal. But Mike Ferrell actually does in his brief appearance here, does a pretty good job. So you've got a toy for a weapon slash a cutting tool. You've got really, I don't know if it was a beach ball or a basketball, but it was some kind of ball hanging from a string that is the Earth. And of course, the lighting is just abysmal on it, so you don't realize that it might be a basketball or a beach ball or something. So the explosion of planet Earth is basically a bunch of colored lights flashing on the surface of this ball, and it's so reflective, it's obvious it's plastic. This is the kind of quality that went into this movie, folks. And then it looks like they might have filled it up with maybe some kind of explosive gas or something that was flammable, and then somebody lit a match. Boom. You know? So this is the extent of the special effects. You've got the plywood sets with your little gauges scattered all over the place, a set that looks like a set. It's just brutal, folks. And I'm going to spoil everything here. I've already spoiled some of it. We already know that Grant Williams' character gets killed with the woman that he has eyes on, played by Laurie Scott. She plays Kate Carlson. And Laurie was supposed to be the pretty girl in this movie. She had a little bit of a career. She did, 15 projects, but pretty much got out of the business after 1983. This was one of the last movies that she made. I know. This is a real career killer. But, she did a little television work here and there on a lot of the TV series from 1959 onward. But she was a competent actress. I remembered her on Man from U.N.C.L.E. because I loved that show. So, she was the pretty gal. Well, they all are. Ruta Lee was very pretty. And, Mayla Powers, although she was supposed to be the older of the three, a very attractive woman. So, they had their good-looking women. And I want to mention Ruta Lee again because she was interviewed by someone years later after this movie did get released and asked about it. I said, what did you think about, being in the Doomsday Machine? And she had nothing but fond memories about it. It was an intense 8 days. Everybody got along. Said it was a very friendly set. She got along with Lee Sholem and all the other folks. And they said, we all had a great time. I think they sort of knew they were in an impossible situation. So they made the best out of it, and they just had a great time. And, Lee Sholem, was very complimentary of Denny Miller, who played Tarzan. And Lee Sholem had worked with Lex Barker. Now, we talked about Lex Barker a few weeks ago in another film we were talking about. And, he said, no, Denny Miller was just, he was just the nicest guy in the world. I loved working with him. People criticizing him about doing all the Tarzan stuff. He says, I worked with another Tarzan who was not so nice, Lex Barker, who was a total egotist, to the point that at the end of this film, the film that he worked with Lex Barker on, the crew got together to buy him a gift for the rap party, and it was a big full-length mirror because they thought he was such an egotist that a mirror would be the best gift you could give him. So, everybody got high marks from cast and crew on this. Everybody enjoyed working with one another. But here's what happens. So they get all the way to Venus finally. They get almost, within, sight range of the planet. And they realize, because of some damage that had happened to the ship You know, and then the horror of there's no Earth anymore. They can't go back. There's nowhere to go back to. The planet's gone. They don't have enough fuel to land safely on Venus because of the weight thing. There's only so much weight they can get rid of. So three people can't go. Three people have to stay behind. Well, it ends up, well, after Grant Williams and Laurie Scott get killed, after her, you know, he's trying to attack her sexually, and they she hits the button to the to the outside door, and boom, they get blown out into space. Bobby Vann's character and Mayla Powers's character, the Russian gal, they decide they're going to stay behind. Of course, Bobby Vann has to go fix something on the spacecraft, and of course, you know, they let him know. They say, you know, you're not coming back. And he accepts it. Yeah, I'm not coming back. And while he's out there fixing it, she shows up, says, it looks like you could use some help. And they stay behind when the other three take off. Ruta Lee's character. And then you've got James Craig's character, Dr. Haynes. And then you've got Denny Miller, who's the commander. So they go off in the Astra towards Venus. Now, there had been a Russian expedition that had gone to Venus and disappeared. Nobody knew what happened. And of course, you got Mayla Powers here with Bobby Vann's character. She's Georgiana Bronski, by the way. I don't think I mentioned her name. And they see in the distance another ship. Sort of looks like one of the ships that got pulled on a string earlier, because, like I said, the Astra changed shape every time you saw it. But it's a Russian ship that had disappeared. So they make it onto that ship. And of course, Georgiana knew the commander of that ship, and they find that they had died. But You got old Danny. He knows, you know, he can fix it. And he gets the ship running and he goes, well, we'll go catch up with the others. And they're finally able to get him on the radio to say, hey, we're still alive and we're headed your way. And then they lose contact with him and the Astra just disappears. And then all of a sudden, this voice comes out of nowhere, I guess through telepathy, and it's the Venusians. And they say, yeah, you're not going to find the Astra. We had to destroy it. They didn't say how they destroyed it, but they're gone. And if you don't get out of here, you're going to be destroyed too, because we've seen what you people do to your planet, and we saw what happened to it, and we're not going to let you infect our planet where it might happen to us. So they send it off. They give it sort of a push and send it to some coordinates in the outer edge of the universe, where there's supposedly a planet that they can settle there and do whatever they want. And then the movie just ends. So you could tell they were in a hurry. Now, there was a lot of footage, like I said, that was shot in 1972, a lot of this taken stock footage from this other film. The spacesuits change from 1967 to 1972. There were basically silver spacesuits with motorcycle helmets. That changes to a more enclosed helmet that you can't see through the visor because they didn't have the original cast, so they couldn't put, you know, they couldn't put the extras or whatever, the doubles into a spacesuit that you could see through, you know, see through the visor, because then you'd know it wasn't the person it was supposed to be. This is a jumbled mess, folks. I know I'm going around and around and around on this. I want to like this movie. I really do, because of the people that are in it. But I just can't. I just can't. It is just so bad. Look, I've myself personally have worked in movies that have had no money and saw what people could do with virtually no money. As long as you've got a crew and a cast that are dedicated, you can pull off some major things. And I think the cast and the crew in this movie would have done that. But this went beyond ineptness. It was almost like a disdain for the audience. And so I think the first time I saw this movie, I was almost insulted at how bad it was. And I saw it on TV. And it was like, why did you even show this? Because, you know, those of us who are monster, grew up monster kids and are monster kids, who always will be a monster kid, we take it seriously. It's like, don't insult us with this garbage. And it's a shame. Don't insult some of our favorite actors and actresses with this. So, folks, this is just a bad, bad movie. Haven't done one of these in quite a while. I think maybe From Hell It Came was the last one that I did sort of like this. And I've got to grudgingly say that this movie makes that movie look good. So those of you that know me know it took quite a bit to say that. Anyway, folks, it's called The Doomsday Machine. Released in 1972, 50 years ago. If you want to watch it for free on YouTube. It's a bad movie, folks. Oh, anyway. Anyway, okay, so we got that one out of our way. Hey, we've been in touch with Clay and Mark and Madeline, and we're trying to get them all coordinated now that everybody's, some of these folks are on summer break. So we're going to see if we can get them all together. We got some fun shows coming your way in the next few weeks. I've got a vacation coming up in August, so I've got to hustle and get a show made so that I can go away on vacation. But folks, we appreciate your support this year. As always, can't say enough about that. This seventh season has been a fun one. It's been a different one and a lot of fun for me. And let's just keep the ball rolling with this. Have a great week, folks. I am doing this show right after the 4th of July. And actually, it's being released on the 4th of July. So if you're listening to it as it just got released, I hope you had a happy 4th of July and had a great week. And we'll see you again next Monday.
Drew Leiter here. Wish you could keep up on DC Comics, but don't have the time or the money? Not a problem. Join Cletus Jacobs and I as we bring you recaps and commentary on DC Comics, television, movies, and more, whether they are good or not. The Earth Station DCU podcast comes out weekly and is part of the ESO Network.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.